What do you hunger for?
That's a really hard question. Falafel.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Rocky Kopernik about her lyric immigrant nonfiction, The Memory House. This interview contains some explicit language. This interview was made possible with the generous support of the Montana Book Festival. Don't go away. This book is called part document, part multi-generational memoir, and 150% relevant. The Memory House shows us family, war, borders, home, persecution, necessity, longing, belonging, and migration as infinite loops by Francesca Volz. And this is a lyric memoir of your family's story, largely based in Israel. And Rocky, I was hoping you would just start by reading the very beginning.
There was a time when there were no gardens. The land was beige and dusty, the water sparse. The only fruit, the prickly pear, difficult to harvest through long spikes. Even those cacti were brought over from Mexico. Back then, before they lived there and for a short while after, the British owned the land, a small piece the size of New Jersey in the middle of the middle of the Middle East, a tender heart at the barely visible center. There's so much space like it for thousands of miles around, but everyone wants the sweet middle, the core, what they think is the soul. Borders are imaginary lines made up by people.
How do you experience borders now?
I think about borders on a large scale, you know, like obviously what's happening in the world. And I think that they've always been there. We need to know where the edges are in order to find the middle, to find balance on a personal level. And I think that they create a space, like an area, for people to feel like this is my home, this is where I am. And on the other side of it, I mean, I really think borders are made up. Whoever has the power gets to make up the border. And then we sort of take what we want and push people out and let people in. And I think as individual people, we're like that too. You know, what's our edges? And I think we're learning and growing and figuring out our boundaries and our edges. I think it's very telling. You know, I think the big people who actually create those kind of borders and edges in the world maybe really aren't so in touch with their own.
I love that you took it to the personal, because one of the things I was thinking about reading your work, both The Memory House and The Other Body, is borders and queerness, borders and gender, you know, obviously borders and land. Is there anything else you would add about borders as they relate to the personal?
The gender thing, I think, is it's a really interesting time thinking about what makes somebody who they are around gender and around edges and around borders and how our bodies look and how they feel. And I don't know.
I felt like you were holding our hand and you took us into this very well-crafted world. And I was hoping you could describe for the listeners the moshav your mother grew up on in the kibbutz.
I never saw that moshav. I saw the kibbutz. I talk about it in my book. I spent a lot of my childhood there. And in my mind, it's this really sweet paradise. By the time I was there, what my grandparents and their generation built there became this really beautiful, magical community for me. But I also was only there in the summers. And it's interesting, my cousin who lives in Israel, who's been in Israel his whole life, and we kind of grew up together, and he grew up in the kibbutz, and he recently texted me a picture of a piece of the book. He started reading the book, and he was like, he was talking about our grandmother and how hard it was for her and how my grandmother and my mother have all this stuff from that time. And he was like, the kibbutz. And he lives now in Tel Aviv, and he's queer too, and him and his boyfriend travel all over all the time. And like, that's the life that they've chosen. And he never looked back and never was like, I'm going to go be there. And I think it was hard for him as a gay person to grow up there. It's very small. I think it's been hard to be gay in Israel for a long time. I think it's getting easier now, but his memory is so different than mine because he was there all the way around and I only was there in the summers. And so I had this like magical summer experience of freedom as a child. We're just free, you know, there was no streets and you just sort of ran around and there were peacocks and gardens.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about your experience going back during the summer. But before that, I was hoping that you would read another piece.
On her fourth birthday, a girl stole my mother's apple juice. There was only one cup of juice per person. There was one small piece of sweet cake made with eggs, sugar, flour, and margarine. No butter. Butter was as rare as chocolate. Chocolate was as rare as an indoor toilet. There was one white dress she got to wear on that birthday, with one red anemone flower stitched on it, and a string that hung around her neck with a faded blue paper four attached, made by her teenage teacher, and a birthday wreath of wildflower weeds to wear on her head.
I was so struck by the relationship between scarcity and abundance. Can you talk about that tension?
Like as childhood of my parents or in my childhood?
Some of the imagery in the book and the content that you circle in the book. Like there's a sense of there are things that were scarce and yet there were abundances of other types of things, whether it's connection or emotion or beauty or flowers.
Right. I think the land, especially in the kibbutz, once it sort of was developed, everybody worked so hard to make it livable. They didn't have anything else. So the sunflowers, the farminess, and also this feeling of community, you know, like the kibbutz was really established as a socialist movement. Communities and things like that, it's this weird juxtapose. When you're suffering and you're struggling and you're pushed out and you're ostracized, it's sort of like how we have queer subculture and punk subculture. I think a lot of people created this subculture. This is what we're going to do. And that sense of resilience, there's nowhere else for us to go. And even here isn't really, it's not 100% ours. Part of why I wanted to tell that story is because I think that now there's this sort of feeling of Jews and Israel and have everything and take everything over. And just I think the history of what came before is so relevant and important and it really gets lost. So I think the abundance of when I was a kid, when I would go to the kibbutz, it felt so abundant. And I think I say something about this in the book, but I had so much more material abundance in America. But going there, I wanted to be there. I loved we're all sharing space and we're all just smushed together. I loved it because it felt, yeah, like the, what you said, like the love abundance.
This book is also so full of sensate details, particularly around food. I wanted to know maybe both what the symbolism of food is and why you felt it necessary to elevate it in the book, and also how food relates to memory.
Yeah. I couldn't not talk about it. Partly, I'm just like that. I love cooking. I'm a huge gardener. To me, it's a way that people come together. It's so cultural. Everybody loves, or not everybody, but people talk about home cooking and how my mom used to cook, or this cultural food is so interesting. And the obvious piece is it's how we live. And it's so reflective of our surroundings. Like, what can we grow and what do we make? And why do we make these certain foods based on the geography and our culture? And that question you asked me in the beginning, what do I hunger for? Like, I know you mean it as a bigger thing, but really it's falafel. I think about the falafel I had there as a kid. You can't get it anywhere else. I wrote about it in the book too, and it's such a giant sandwich in there of all the feelings and all the experience, and it's salty and tangy and nourishing and sweet, and it's all the things in there, in the pita bread. Food is just such a big part of the culture, and then that goes into the memory. You know, it's like when you taste something and the memory comes back, or you hear music, or you smell something, all the senses, definitely like smells of food, the way that the memories come out. Yeah, I just think it's the deepest connection. And I think it's a way that also, especially when people are struggling and suffering, you create new food out of the minimal things that you have. And then that becomes the cultural food. I mean, we can see that in so many different cultures. And I think that's a way that we say everything's okay. You know, food is very grounding. Everything's okay here. We have this food. We made this food. We made these cookies. We made this dish, whatever it is. You know, I think that my grandmother, she was an amazing cook, an amazing baker, and my mom's mom, that was like a way that she communicated was through, I didn't actually put this in the book, but she would make cream cakes, these just weird cream cakes, and we always looked forward to them. And she only made them when we came for the summer. And it was this, such a gift, you know. I love you. Have some cake.
Later in the book, you write, memory has a mind of its own. Magical times interweave seamlessly with the challenges we want to forget. And I can hear the magic when you talk about food. And I also was hoping that you would speak to some of the challenges and that place of recognition, maybe for your parents, about where they chose to remember and what they chose to forget.
Yeah, that was such an interesting process to sit down with them. So I sat down with them and I asked them if I could record their stories and just sort of interview them. And as I was doing it, I was like, oh, this is really important, regardless of a book. Now I'm really understanding their stories in a deeper way that I didn't understand. Even now, they'll tell me more stories and I'm like, oh, why didn't you tell me that? That's such a good story. Do I have to write another book? Yeah. I don't know why they chose to tell me the stories they told me or why they remembered or didn't remember in the moments that we were talking. But I do know that for my dad, you know, and I wrote about this, his memory was very short and selective, and he didn't really want to talk about his childhood. And I think I wrote that it's like he maybe didn't remember or didn't want to remember. There are things, I think, that happened for him that were really hard in a different way than it was hard for my mom. You know, it was hard for my mom in that they were really poor, but she had more of like a love support system. I think my dad's family is very cold. I think he didn't have it, and so he either doesn't want to go back into the memory, or maybe he's blocked it out and doesn't remember. But I think it's interesting, what do we remember? I think memory is so based on feeling and experience as opposed to like remembering a fact. And that's why I think we can remember the same, we were both there at the same time, a conversation we had, and our memories are so different because it's the emotion you are feeling is what you remember, you know?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Rocky Kopernik about her book, The Memory House. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You chronicle your parents' love story, which began around the time of the Six-Day War in 1967. And you write, romance seemed redundant next to the weight of the war. Maybe this is a real far out question, but what can you say about romance and war, maybe even in your own life?
I think when I was writing that, it was really my interpretation. They didn't say that. It was kind of the way that it felt to me when they were telling me about the timeline of their relationship and all the things that were happening in the world. And then I think there we also have this romanticism about war, which is so strange to me. I think the romanticism is more about the era, like the 40s and the Second World War and even further back. In my life, I don't really find a relationship between those things. I think it's so unromantic and it's so heartbreaking. It's sad to me. I don't feel like I have a connection. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
In thinking about war, one of the things I was struck by and knew prior to reading your book, but was re-reminded, is in Israel, women can go into the army, or that's part of the initiation process of being a teenager.
They have to go.
They have to go. Yeah. And you write, I wanted to belong, but I knew I never would. I would never go to the army, and not going to the army excluded you from everything. The army made a person Israeli, transitioned a teenager into an adult. So can you explain maybe that part of Israeli culture, but particularly as it relates to women and girls? What does it mean?
I think it's really evolved. So I think that now it's really different. And I don't really know because I haven't been there in a long time. And the cousins and people I'm in touch with are actually all men, really. And we're so far past the age at this point, too. You know, I'm in my 40s now, and you go right after high school. So here, people travel or people go to college, and there it's literally like going to school. You have to go. So again, it's different now. I think in a way there's more resistance now, and in a way it's harder now, because when my mom talks about it, she says that it was like so fun. She made connections with people like camp in a way. After you do basic training, there's a lot of options, or there were. I can't speak for right now, but when my mom was in it, she enjoyed it because she wanted to be a teacher. And so they sent her to a school. There's also this really beautiful thing about it. Like, the country is taking care of the people and they teach you all kinds of skills. Like, my dad learned how to be a mechanic and then was a mechanic for a very long time and can fix anything. And same with another cousin of mine, the brother of the other cousin I was talking about. If you got to do something that you were interested in, and there were a lot of options, it was like free schooling, and you got to learn skills, and you got a little money, and you had community with you, and you always were with other women who were soldiers. And I mean, I don't think that women were ever front lines, and I don't think they were ever in super dangerous situations. That said, a lot of people used to hitchhike around all the time, especially in the 80s. Wasn't a lot of money. People didn't have cars. There weren't as good of roads even. And there were a lot of terrible stories about women soldiers hitchhiking. So that's the other side of it. They're also so young. You know, they go to the army when they're 18 and they don't really know much, especially women like my mom who are coming from a kibbutz where they were just sheltered in this tiny little community and they didn't have a lot of opportunity to leave because there was no money. There's a duality for sure.
How did you find your own initiation then? What helped you sort of feel like you were becoming an adult?
Oh, because I didn't go to the army?
Yeah.
Well, that's a different story. That's not this story. But if we're going into the other book that I have here, is coming into queerness. I also was a little bit wild. So there were those
classic American.
Classic American immigrant. I actually really, really pulled away from my family, and I didn't care about my identity as a Jew and as an Israeli. And there were other things in my family that were hard, and I really was rebellious and resisted and pulled away for a long time. So the ways that I arrived in myself were not through my family, but other. Although my mom is an artist too, and she always was really supportive of me. I was a dancer and of doing dance and art and all the stuff. So both and again.
Before we move on to your next body of work, I was hoping you would finish by reading part of the end of The Memory House.
I thought about living in Israel when I was 19. My mother said she would follow me if I went. She had friends who had gone back. Their kids followed them. When I reminded her of this conversation, she said, "That's not true. I never said that." Our memory is woven together. Mine fills in for hers, hers for mine. It was the mid-90s, suicide bombings growing exponentially, buses exploding, cafes getting blasted, Hamas Rising. I didn't go. There's a hole in my body, under my ribcage, around my organs. Sometimes I dream in Hebrew. When I wake, the hole is temporarily filled. I rise, I read the newspaper, listen to the radio, walk down the street, talk to people in English. Tears in the thin hole wall begin again. There is no one way, no one straight line, no one yes, no, no one is, isn't. Delicate sheets shield the timeline of our stories, protect our hearts, make our distance, our loops, our spirals bearable. Same, different, same. We are not made of angles. We are made of woven memory circles.
I want to ask one last question about this book. The book is a weaving, and I was trying to imagine when you're an old person and someone was to write, you know, your history, your story, how could you imagine them doing it, or how would you want them to approach, you know, being the daughter of immigrants and growing up in America?
Oh, that's really interesting to think about. I have thought about it a little bit. So my partner has a 9-year-old daughter, and she lives with us part-time. And sometimes I think about, what's she going to say when she's in her 20s about what her home life was like and what it was like when she was with us, and what's she going to say about me? She came to my book release for the Memory House. I was a little bit worried that she would be bored or that she would be kind of like, ugh. And she just stared. I mean, I caught her eye several times. She was just looking at me. And afterwards, she was like, that was so cool. I loved it. It was like you were just telling me stories. It was so just heartwarming that she felt a connection to my story. And she obviously knows my parents, but they're not in her life like her other grandparents. She sees them maybe once a year. And so she's not really wrapped up in my family, like my family of origin family. I hope she's like, oh, it was so cool. I heard her read her book and she wrote books and it's very inspiring. And I hope that's how she feels about it and sees it. And who knows, though, whatever comes out of it will be okay. Those will be her stories.
Your chapbook, The Other Body, seems to be a conversation with sexuality, gender, and a particular relationship. What can you speak to about what you are working through in that piece?
I think everything I write comes from personal experience, so it's somewhat of a personal experience. Not everything in there is exactly true. It's very to interpretation. I arrived in this identity, and it definitely has shifted and changed. I mean, I came out when I was probably 19, and it was a different time. And around that time is when some of my friends started coming out as trans. And I always was like, what is my identity? Am I kind of more butch? Am I kind of more this way or that way? Or it took so long to kind of arrive at what actually is my gender identity. And then seeing my friends coming out as trans and bouncing myself off of that as, well, I know it's not that, sort of everything that's in between. And it's still growing and it's still changing. And I don't know if that answers your question. I just kind of made a circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was hoping that you would read one of the poems toward the end of the book.
We make choices, then lie in bed cuddling consequence. Consequence isn't always corrupt, when it's hugged, not punished, like a milk spiller. When I was little, my mom would say, if you don't stop, there will be consequences. So I thought consequence was a noun, a thing that could be handed over. I was right.
What are the consequences of loving for you?
I'm thinking about that question in connection to how it relates in here, because the story was a long time ago, and I think I've grown so much out of the madness of love, and it's become much more grounded and even and consistent. I don't know now that there's consequence. You know, I think now it's experience and it's information as opposed to a consequence that you're like, oh, I don't think I have that anymore in love and relationship. I think it's more like a response instead of a consequence.
Both of these books strike me as documentarian works. And I just wanted to know, what is the value in charting our lives?
I think you're right. They are both. And I think they both, for me, speak to remembering who laid the path for you, where you came from, what happened before, and how you're able now to be who you are and do what you do because of the people that came before us that allowed us, especially in queerness. I think there's a lot of judgment about now there's the younger generation and they're like, oh, you do this and you say this and you... And I was like that too. I remember being like that too. I think every new generation has that. We forget who came before us and who laid the groundwork and also how hard it was, especially the family story. It's likely that almost, I don't know, 100% of people's parents had a harder life than we have now in some way or another. It's not always like the immigrant story. To me, I think it creates also a sense of hopefulness, and I don't really think that I'm a super hopeful person, but when I look at how it was, my partner and I say this all the time. If we watch an older queer movie, we're like, thank God it's not like that anymore for us, and we can walk down the street holding hands. Partly why I wrote this book was because I started to understand ancestral trauma, which was a thing that I heard about, but I never knew. And all of a sudden, after the last election, I had this breakdown and I couldn't stop crying for days. And I was like, what's happening? I'm so scared. I think it was starting to understand the trauma because there started to be all this anti-Semitism. It's always there. Racism's always there. But there was all this permission for it to rise and to come out at people. I started to feel really scared. And that was part of why I wrote this book, was to remember, even still, I'm feeling scared, but to remember how much harder it was. The past is so important to remember. It's how we got to the present. It's how we got to where we are.
Rocky Kopernik is a queer Jewish fiction and poetry writer. She's the author of The Things You Left, The Other Body, and The Memory House, which was a finalist for the Red Hen Press Nonfiction Award. She lives in Minneapolis. Her full bio can be found at our website at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.